of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here, we enlighten you with the ayah 61 of Surah Yunus, recited by Ahmad Mirza Devaghifi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وما تكون في شأن وما تتلو وَمَا تَتْلُو مِنْهُ مِنْ قُرْآنٍ وَلَا تَعْمَلُونَ مِنْ عَمَلٍ إِلَّا كُنَّا عَلَيْكُمْ شُهُودًا وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب مبين وما يعزب عن ربك من مثقال ذرة في الأرض ولا في السماء ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أصغر من ذلك ولا أكبر إلا في كتاب صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. And you are not engaged in any affair, nor do you recite concerning it any portion of the Quran, nor do you do any work, but we are witnesses over you when you enter into it. And there does not lie concealed from your Lord the weight of an atom in the earth, or in the heaven, nor anything less than that, nor greater, but it is in a clear book.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Millions of Iranians are heading to the polls to elect members of the country's parliament and the Assembly of Experts. Leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution calls on voters to cast their ballots in the early hours of voting, saying that a huge turnout will disappoint the enemies of the nation. And the UN rights chief warns Israel's ground invasion of the southern Gaza city of Rafah will incur potentially massive loss of life of people sheltering there. It's election day here in Iran, and people are heading to polls to cast their ballots for parliament and assembly of experts. Voters are taking part in parliamentary elections to choose 290 members of the legislative body from over 15,000 candidates. Elected members will serve a term of 4 years in parliament. In another election being held simultaneously, participants are voting for 88 members of the Assembly of Experts. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution casted his ballot for both elections in the early minutes after polling stations opened nationwide. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei urged the Iranian nation to go to the polls as soon as possible, saying people's participation will disappoint the country's ill-wishers. More than 61 million people are eligible to vote. And now joining us is Press TV correspondent Mahdi Abbasian and Farzan Oshudian, both joining us from the Iranian capital. We're going to start with Mahdi, the latest, if you can, the polling station you are at, my friend. What can you tell us?
Well, Daniel, I'm currently in one of the mosques in central Tehran, which is a polling station. Since the early hours of the beginning of the elections, people showed up at this place as well as other polling stations across the city to cast their ballots. What we can see here on the ground is the presence of both men, women, young and old, to participate in key elections that will determine the future of Iranians. As you said, the 12th term of the Iranian parliament as well as the 6th term of the Assembly of Experts are the elections that people are here today to cast their ballots. The thing I have to mention that today is Friday, and despite the very cold weather in Tehran, still people have showed up to cast their votes in the early hours of the day. The voting process will continue for 10 hours, and then we will see if the because there is a possibility that this time they just give it more time and renew the time for the voting. Now, among the people who have showed up here today were Iranian politicians and high-ranking officials, including the economy minister, who just arrived here minutes ago to cast his vote. And that's it.
Right. And as doors open, Mahdi, how's the crowd control so far? Is it fairly crowded, or are the people still trickling in the early hours there?
Well, I told you, because it's Friday and it's a day off, and the cold weather, the people just planned to be here on time after the polls were open. The presence of people since the early hours, 8 a.m., that the local time that the voting process began, was noticeable. There were lots of people here at the place that I'm located in. This continues. The crowd, the voters come in and leave, and so far the presence was good, and right. It's expected that this will continue for several hours until the end of the election.
We'll monitor things closely and check in with you frequently there, Mahdi. Thanks, and I'm going to swing now over to Farzan Oshudian, correspondent, who is kind of drifting up between polling station to polling station. Hello, Farzana. Where are you at now? I believe you have changed your location. What can you tell us?
Danny, I'm still here in Hosseini Irshad, and I can see that the number of the voters is significantly actually rising, and the crowd actually is getting more and more. And what I witnessed actually here, and what took my attention here about the voters, is the young generation and the families that have brought their children to see that they are voting. And one of actually the fathers that were here to cast his vote, and I heard him talking and expressing his thoughts. He said that he's doing this, and he's actually using this right while bringing his child to the polling station to actually show his child that it is important to be a participant in the country's future. And of course, people from all walks of life, from different views, are here to cast their vote. And the young generation, as I mentioned, I talked to them and asked them that to actually express their thoughts and feelings. And they said that it is important for them to be here and participate in the voting in order to actually choose the representatives of both for the parliament and the assembly of experts. We know that along with the different political views, different actually five religious minorities also are actually have the right to participate and run for the election, including the Zoroastrians Jews. I can see here that people are just, the crowd is getting more and more. People have a list of their candidates, that they're writing their names. Of course, there are lists here that people can choose from different political spectrums, different political views, and different medias are also here to broadcast this important day where the two key elections for both the parliament and the assembly of experts is underway. And I saw here Mr. Natav Nuri casted his vote. He's a important political figure of the country. And of course, the candidates were here. One of the candidates from the assembly of experts was here, and he casted his vote along with his family. And that's it. Back to you.
Thank you, Faizane. And a lot of parents do that. They bring their young out to teach them of civic duty and civic responsibility on this day of voting. And for our viewers, these are live images from polling stations. That's one. That's Sanandaj there and on the western part of the Iranian of Iran and of the country there. Over 59,000 voting stations are operational right now as we speak throughout the country, just 5,000 alone in the Iranian capital. We've over 61.2 million Iranians are eligible to cast their ballots, and earlier leader of the Islamic Revolution cast his ballots. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei encouraged people to get out and vote as soon as possible and not to play into the enemy's hands, as ill-wishers would like to see a low turnout. And he's called it all week, one of the pillars of the Islamic Republic and one of the pillars of democracy is the vote. It's a power in the people's hands. Use it. Don't let it squander this opportunity to be part of the political landscape of the country and its future. Meanwhile, and now to occupy Palestine, where Israel continues to massacre Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip. In the latest attack, regime forces shot at starving people while they're waiting for food in northern Gaza. At least 112 Palestinians were killed and more than 700 injured. And we discussed the latest developments with our guests earlier in our news review program.
The scenes of horrific killing of Palestinians have become common ever since the Israeli regime launched its genocidal war in the Gaza Strip. The regime forces have massacred scores more Gazans who were waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza City. According to the Palestinian Health Ministry, 112 people were killed after Israeli snipers shot directly at a crowd waiting for aid in the early morning. Hundreds more sustained injuries. The dead and wounded have been taken to Al-Shifa and Kamal Adwan hospitals. Palestinian Foreign Ministry has condemned the attack, saying that it was a cold-blooded massacre. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas and the Islamic Jihad have also censured the massacre of Gazans. Palestinians are already struggling with shortages of food, as the Israeli regime is using starvation as a weapon against them. Shortages have caused a surge in malnutrition among children, with the UN warning of a looming famine. The Israeli genocide has so far killed over 30,100 Gazans. Rick Sterling is an investigative journalist joining us from Walnut Creek in California. We also have Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today, joining us from Saidiya over in Morocco. Welcome to you both. Rick Sterling, I'll start with you. There's a couple real shocking, not that before we didn't hear shocking news coming out of the Gaza Strip. One of them is the fact that you have people in one particular incident that's now been broadcast that are eating cactus for food. The other is the massacre that took place where the military aid convoy comes, not the military, but an aid convoy comes, Palestinians line up for food, and then they get shot at by the regime forces and they killed over 100. These are gross violations. This particular one, the massacre, that's a genocide that's taking place, and it's a war crime. We're still looking at this happening. What do you make of the fact that this is still continuing by the Israeli regime?
Well, I think Israel is spitting in the face of the International Court of Justice, which ruled at the end of January that Israel should stop this. And they're just continuing as before. They've prevented food and drinking water and medications to come into Gaza. They've severely restricted it. They've tried to get all of the people out of northern Gaza to flush them into southern Gaza and Rafah. Israel has bombed the bakeries. And now when the starving people are congregating, trying to get food, the Israeli tanks and soldiers have fired on the civilians lining up to try to get food. So it's just another continuation of the genocide.
Taking a look at the way that this genocide has continued, Kevin Barrett, it would not happen were it not for the U.S. support militarily to the Israeli regime. We had at one point where a Pentagon spokesperson has said that Israel has unfettered access to military equipment of all kinds, bombs, you name it. That's happening almost on a daily basis, if not on a daily basis. So doesn't that make the U.S. Complicit in this and as guilty?
Yes, the U.S. is 100% complicit, and American leaders ought to be right up there on the defendant's stand in the world court, along with the Israeli leaders, and they all need to be tried, convicted, and sentenced, and in many cases executed. These are among the worst war criminals in history. There's no reason that this has to happen. You know, there are wars that are driven by actual necessity. This is not. This is basically an act of pure aggression by these Zionist genocidal maniacs who have a crazy fundamentalist religious view. It's actually not even an authentic traditional religious view, but it's a satanic spin-off of a millenarian messianic kind of lunacy that's been percolating in that community for hundreds of years now, and it's turned into to sheer genocide driven by utter madness. There's no military purpose to luring people, to starving them until they show up in the thousands to try to get a sack of flour, and then firing into the crowd with tanks, which is what just happened. Killing over 100 people and wounding many, many hundreds more.
Let me thank Rick Sterling, investigative journalist there from Walnut Creek, California, and also Kevin Barrett, editor at Veterans Today, spoke to us from Saidiya over in Morocco. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to an end for this news review.
Condemnations continue pouring in from throughout the world following the Israeli massacre of over 100 Palestinians waiting for life-saving aid in northern Gaza. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman described the attack on defenseless civilians as barbaric. Nasser Kanani said shame of supporting and remaining silent towards Israeli genocide will remain with the false champions of human rights in the United States and Europe. Meanwhile, the UN aid chief expressed shock at the incident. Martin Griffiths said he was appalled at the killing of hundreds of people during the transfer of aid in Gaza. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres also denounced the deadly attack.
The Secretary General condemns the incident today in northern Gaza, in which more than 100 people were reportedly killed or injured while seeking life-saving aid.
The Palestinian ambassador to the UN urged the Security Council to condemn the massacre. Riyad Mansour said as long as the council is paralyzed, then Palestinians will continue to lose their lives. Turkey said massacre proves Israel is consciously and collectively destroying the Palestinian people. Colombia's President Gustavo Petro described the attack as genocide, saying his country has now suspended all purchases of weapons from Israel. Canada's foreign minister called Israel's killing Palestinians in Gaza a nightmare. Spain slammed the Gaza massacre as unacceptable, while France called it unjustified. The UN human rights chief once again issues a stark warning against Israel's planned ground assault of the southern Gaza city of Rafah.
A ground assault would incur potentially massive loss of life, additional risk of atrocity crimes, new displacement to another unsafe location distribution, and sign a death warrant for any hope of effective humanitarian aid. For my part, I fail to see how such an operation could be consistent with the binding provisional measures that were issued by the International Court of Justice.
Turk told the UN Human Rights Council an attack on Rafah will take a nightmare that is being inflicted on Gazans to a new dimension. He slammed regime's attacks and killings in Gaza as examples of Israel's brutality and carnage. Turk stressed there are no words to capture the horrors that are unfolding in Gaza. Rafah is the territory's most populated area, where over 1.5 million people are sheltering. They have nowhere safe to go, and many of them have already been displaced multiple times. Thanks for tuning in, and bye-bye for now.
The whole world is silent towards oppression, even one voice becomes powerful. IRIB English Radio, the voice of the voiceless. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
On Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
Limelight. Foreign interference in European affairs is frowned upon unless that interference comes from the Zionist regime and its supporters. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, foreign interference in European affairs is frowned upon unless that interference comes from the Zionist regime and its supporters. A group called the European Leadership Network has been responsible for much of the interference. The European Leadership Network's goal is to make lawmakers on both sides of the Atlantic equally beholden to the Zionist regime. Its website notes that while 80% of US Congress members have visited Israel, only 10% of European counterparts have done so. To rectify that imbalance, the group regularly organizes junkets to the West Asia region. Since October 7th, it has hosted 12 solidarity missions for politicians who approve of the genocidal war against Gaza. Involving sojourns in luxury hotels, the trips have invariably been expensive. One British lawmaker estimated that the bill for his participation in a recent four-day visit hosted by the European Leadership Network exceeded $2,500. Despite how it is buying influence, the activities of and the agenda pursued by the European Leadership Network have been subject to hardly any scrutiny in the mainstream media. Although its fundraising arm is based in Illinois, many of the group's activities are coordinated from its Tel Aviv office. That office is headed by Emmanuel Navon, a self-proclaimed scholar and practitioner of diplomacy. Navon was born and raised in France before moving to Israel as an adult. It is a testament to Navon's political acumen that he and his staff have cultivated strong relations with the European Union and other pillars of the West, while taking positions that are at complete variance with their stated values. Navon, for example, does not believe in the principle of equality to which the EU is nominally wed. In 2018, Navon, then part of the right-wing Colette Policy Forum, wrote a piece for the Jerusalem Post defending the Zionist regime's nation-state law. Through that law, the child killer regime of Israel implicitly confirmed that it operates an apartheid system in which Jews are given a higher status than people of other religions or ethnicity. In 2020, Navon contended that Europe should rethink its position to the Zionist regime threats that it may formally annex a large part of the occupied West Bank. Navon used convoluted reasoning to claim that annexation, the possible extension of Israeli sovereignty, as he called it, would be consistent with international law. Undoubtedly, erudit, at least in his own head, Navon is not actually a trained lawyer. His attempts over the past few weeks to dismiss how the International Court of Justice has found there is a plausible case that Israel is committing genocide are therefore meritless. Rather than dealing with the substance of the case, he has sought to besmirch South Africa, the government which brought it. South Africa has displayed a moral clarity in holding the child killer regime of Israel accountable. Yet Navon insists, without proof, that South Africa has only initiated proceedings because it is on the payroll of Qatar and Iran. Although the European Union initially backed the genocidal war on Gaza, fallaciously presenting it as an act of self-defense by the Zionist regime, the death toll is too high now for some key players, the Brussels hierarchy. Josep Borrell, the EU's foreign policy chief, has made that point. Navon's bloodthirst has still not been quenched. He recently described as necessary the threatened major offensive against Rafah, Gaza's southernmost city, where more than 1 million people displaced people are now crammed in appalling conditions. Josep Borrell need not worry about Gaza civilians in the event of such an attack, Navon has said, repeating Israeli regime assurances that non-combatants will be safely evacuated. Perhaps the only thing less sincere than an official assurance from the Zionist regime's government or military is Navon's own attempt to pretend he cares about civilian life. He has, in effect, excused the bombardment of hospitals, the destruction of mosques, and desecration of graves by baselessly claiming that they are hiding places for Hamas. Navon has made equally absurd allegations against the UN Agency for Palestine Refugees, UNRWA. In a bizarre video, he has sought to dress up the Zionist regime's allegations about Hamas having tunnels beneath UNRWA's Gaza offices as facts. UNRWA administrators surely knew about the digging under their building, according to Navon. It would be comforting if we could simply treat such propaganda as evidence-free idiocy, yet it is part of a concreted push to deny Palestinians the essential services that UNRWA provides. Smear campaigns have been run against the UN agency for quite a few years, as it has been designed to distract from the slaughter and starvation which the Zionist regime is inflicting on Gaza. The latest smear campaign is surely the most sinister so far.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Midstream.
Last week, the second edition of the Paris meeting took place in the French capital, attended by representatives from Zionist Israel, the United States, Egypt, and Qatar, with the aim of solidifying the negotiating framework that will guide the indirect negotiations between the Palestinian resistance Hamas and the Israeli entity. However, after the Israeli entity signed backtracked from what was agreed upon in Paris previously under the direction and pressure of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who prevented his negotiating team from returning to Cairo to continue the talks and had stripped them of their powers, delegating his special advisor instead. This made it clear that no one can trust the commitment of the occupation even to what it and the mediators would agree upon in Paris too. Moreover, it is evident that the U.S. administration exerted strong pressure on the Israeli regime, specifically on Netanyahu, to push for the meeting and attempt to reach a deal in the coming weeks. Americans and other mediators are striving to finalize an exchange agreement and a temporary ceasefire before the onset of the holy month of Ramadan in about 2 weeks. They believe that the continued fighting during the fasting month, along with the anticipated restrictions imposed on Palestinians in the West Bank and the occupied territories regarding access to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, would constitute the perfect recipe for significant and comprehensive escalation within occupied Palestine as a whole and even in the region, given that the holy month of Ramadan has typically witnessed clear security escalations in recent years. It has now become clear that the Israeli occupation seeks to close the file of captives in order to resume its field operations, relieved from the pressure of this issue, which burdens the Israeli entity decision maker and does not grant him wide maneuvering margins, whether in combat or at the negotiating table. However, on the other hand, Hamas realizes that this issue is one of the most influential factors on the Israeli entity leadership and its performance in the war, which means that Hamas will not rush to abandon it unless what it gets in return is no less than an agreement on a ceasefire. However, Netanyahu remains adamant against any formula that includes a long-term truce or a temporary cessation of hostilities for long months, as it seems that he has not yet made a real decision whether or not to invade Rafah. In related context, Egyptian sources informed the Wall Street Journal that Hamas is ready to agree to the Israeli occupation's release of 3,000 Palestinian detainees during the exchange deal. But the Zionist soldiers' captives will remain with the Palestinian resistance until a permanent agreement is reached for a comprehensive ceasefire. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. It seems that the decision regarding the Rafah operation is still pending, not only due to field-related reasons, as the attack on Rafah requires different and more complicated preparations than what happened in other areas, but also because the situation there is contingent upon the positions of other parties in the war, whether they are partners to Zionist Israel or maybe mediators who at this stage refuse any attack on the city of Rafah and prefer a negotiated path to end the fighting, albeit under different names, through a relatively improved prisoner swap deal. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Omar Nashebi, political analyst and lawyer expert in human rights, supervisor of the Al-Qaws supplement, which is published weekly with the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Omar. Now, as talks are underway in Paris, and possibly as Reuters said the other day that they might continue in Qatar, does the Israeli regime really seek to maybe end his captives file, where the pressure would be released from there, and then continue his military campaign inside of Gaza with more intensity? Or is it really a very tense situation internally for Netanyahu that the Zionist entity has to be pushed into stopping this aggression, this genocidal aggression against Gaza?
Yes, well, now for more than 140 days, the genocide in Gaza is ongoing. The Israeli army has been killing people constantly since more than 140 days, using more than 60,000 tons of explosives and bombs thrown at an area that is not much larger than 360 square kilometers, where 2 million people are squeezed in this area. And now they're squeezed even more in a 50 square kilometer zone near Rafah, near the Egyptian border, where the Netanyahu and the Israelis are threatening, and they are bombing. They are bombing Rafah. Last night they bombed Rafah, they killed. Every day they're killing around 100, 150 civilians in the Rafah area. They want to do a full invasion there. And, well, they're using this in the negotiations. And that's so unethical. You know, you don't go to negotiations and threaten people, threaten civilians with massacres in order to improve the conditions in the negotiations. This is a total outrage. I mean, this is what Netanyahu's government has been doing. They've been putting on the table, you know, they want to win time, so they want to delay these negotiations as much as possible while they spill the blood of innocent civilians in Rafah and continue to destroy every possible means of life in Gaza and in Rafah more specifically now. This is outrageous. I mean, the negotiations were supposed to be over four different areas. First, the exchange of the prisoners. Mm-hmm. Second, the ceasefire, cessation of hostilities and bombing of civilian infrastructure, civilian hospitals, everything that has to do with life in Gaza. Mm-hmm. And fourth, the removal, the withdrawal of the Israeli army from the northern part and from parts of Gaza so people can return home. You know, and there is no way that the Palestinians will accept that the Israelis create buffer zones. In fact, the Americans said that they will not accept the buffer zone issue. Mm-hmm. And the last thing is the return of the people to their homes and the start of the reconstruction. Where is all that in the negotiations? They only want the hostages, the prisoner exchange. For the prisoner exchange, okay, the Palestinians were ready to actually offer, saying, okay, fine, we will accept. We will accept to discuss the actual swap of one Israeli to 10 Palestinians. Detainees. However, there is no agreement over the names, because the Palestinians have in mind a list of names of people that Netanyahu is not ready to actually release and exchange. Mm-hmm. And that is also a serious obstacle.
This is what I want to discuss
the biggest
with you.
Obstacle, I have to tell you, Marwa, mm-hmm. the biggest obstacle is the issue of ceasefire and permanent ceasefire. Because mm-hmm. every time there was a deal, and in the previous time when there was the exchange of prisoners, the Israelis intensified the bombardment the arrests of mm-hmm. innocent Palestinians. So what is this exchange about? If every time we do the exchange, the Israeli army goes into the West Bank and in Gaza and arrest thousands of
people, definitely. But because I want to discuss with you the requests by the Palestinian resistance, Hamas, who said that they are ready to exchange the captives, the Israeli captives they have, with 3,000 Palestinian detainees from Israeli entity prisons. But and they want to keep the soldier captives with them in order to ensure that the ceasefire will happen. Now, whether or not this happens, that's not what we want to discuss. In the event it actually happens, let's say it does actually happen, what kind of proof does the Palestinian side have that the Zionist entity won't just start a new unforeseeable attack against residents' areas in Gaza?
Now, the massacre and the genocide, the Israeli genocide in Gaza has been going on now for more than 5 months. So let's go back to the beginning, when Hamas actually, from the beginning, and there's nothing new, they said all of the prisoners for all of the prisoners, you know, a swapping deal. That was the offer. The Israelis refused this offer. Okay, so we went to the exchange of the actual civilians and people who were guests, as Hamas called them, and there was this exchange, Hamas and the Islamic Jihad, and there was this operation in the past. Today, what Hamas is saying, okay, there is on the table a proposition that a ratio of 1 to 10, one Israeli for every 10, but that only applies for 35 of the prisoners, not of the 135. Mm-hmm. If there would be a general deal for the full number of prisoners, I think that Hamas and the Islamic Jihad have said before that they are ready for this exchange. Mm-hmm. All of the prisoners in the Israeli concentration camps and prisons, mm-hmm. for all of the prisoners that are the captives of Hamas, mm-hmm. and the resistance and the Islamic Jihad.
Well,
that could be a deal. But what guarantees? Of course, there are no guarantees.
Definitely.
There are no guarantees. But if Hamas gets this deal, it's a big victory. It's an important victory. But the Israelis should know that Hamas and the Islamic Jihad did this proposal from the beginning. It is Netanyahu who made them go more into war and do more bloodshed and more massacres and more destruction and more complicating issues and complicating any path towards the minimum agreement that would stop this genocide.
Definitely, because
to
be honest with you, Dr. Nashebe, the Zionist entity propaganda concerning the grand invasion of Rafah has been severe for the past month at least, but especially for the past 2 weeks. But let's say Netanyahu actually achieves what he wants from any upcoming peace talk or any upcoming negotiating talk, let's say, an agreement that might see the withdrawal of the captives of the captives of the Zionist entity.
But excuse me to interrupt you. I have to say that I think that, you know, the media, the Israeli media, and the talk about Rafah is blackmailing. It's mm-hmm. to blackmail the Americans
but
and the
issue,
international
it's,
community.
You say it's to blackmail the Americans, but if what Netanyahu wants happens, will he suffice with what he has done so far in Gaza, or has the decision to invade Rafah been taken?
I think that Netanyahu has the whole will to actually destroy what's left and kill what's left of the innocent civilians that are trapped in Rafah. However, and he knows that the Americans don't want him to do that, so he keeps talking about this in order to blackmail and to put more pressure on the international community and find justifications. And he thinks, and he said it, in fact, he said that the more we threaten with blood, the blood of children and the blood of, and that would improve the actual stance of the Israelis on the negotiating table, as we said in the beginning. And that's completely unethical and unacceptable in any negotiation process. You don't threaten with the blood of women and children and hospitals in order to improve the conditions and the negotiations. Mm-hmm. That is completely against international humanitarian law.
Mm-hmm. Well, within the norms that is happening right now and within the history that we know the Zionist entity, Dr. Nashebe, no one really trusts the Zionist entity, and apparently not even their allies trust them anymore. But I want to really thank you very much for being with us this morning in Beirut. Dr. Amar Nashebe, political analyst and lawyer expert in human rights, supervisor of the Al-Qaws supplement, which you can find published weekly with the Lebanese newspaper Al-Akhbar, and I do advise you to follow because it's a really very important supplement. Thank you, Dr. Nashebe, for being with us. Ladies and gents, please stay tuned because next we are going to talk about Yemen, how they are adamant, Yemenis are adamant on supporting the people of Palestine, and they will not stop until the Zionist entity stops its genocidal war on Gaza.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
The naval forces of Sana'a continue to flexibly execute their operations in the Red Sea, the Arabian Sea, and the Gulf of Aden, while they persist in surprising the American and British navies. Following each operation that threatens the American and British vessels, the latter navies deploy swarms of drones and warplanes to patrol the international waters to protect the vessels and destroyers from Yemeni drone attacks, then carry out attacks on areas that have been already targeted before, meaning they have no real targets there. More details in the following report.
Events and developments are rapidly unfolding at the levels of direct confrontation between Yemen on one side and the United States and its allies and proxy armies on the other. U.S. and British Navy are intentionally concealing many facts about the almost daily operations carried out by the Yemeni naval forces against their ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden in support of the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. Although the U.S. Fifth Fleet, based in Bahrain, recently acknowledged the difficulty of confronting the Yemeni side, it did not address the strikes that targeted American ships and destroyers. Conversely, military experts in Sana'a affirm that there are escalating military operations against American and British military ships and warships. This reality has become evident to the United States, which has acknowledged facing its biggest challenge since World War II. With 7,000 American soldiers at sea experiencing fatigue and exhaustion after more than 4 months of confrontation without adequate rest or leave, they were caught off guard by the military capabilities of Sana'a, including its large stockpile of missiles and drones with advanced features capable of bypassing major defense systems and reaching the closest level in the defense system, as reported by the Financial Times, citing Lisa Franchetti, the commander of the U.S. Navy. Recently, Admiral Brad Cooper, the deputy commander of the U.S. Navy in the Middle East, admitted in an interview to CBS's 60 Minutes that their forces in the Red Sea, Gulf of Aden, and the Arabian Sea are operating at a combat tempo unseen since World War II. He stated that their military ships are under attack with only 9 to 15 seconds to decide to intercept missiles traveling at speeds of up to 3,000 miles per hour, acknowledging the military superiority of Yemen. Second Truth confirming the unprecedented quagmire for the United States and a highly costly war of attrition is Cooper's admission of the U.S. Navy launching about 100 missiles from its standard land-to-air missiles, each costing about $4 million U.S. dollars, against Yemeni missiles or drones worth only thousands of dollars. This means that the United States of America spent nearly $500 million on the cost of intercepting missiles alone, not to mention the cost of airstrikes and Tomahawk missiles launched at Yemeni land, operational expenses for about 7,000 American fighters, surveillance, reconnaissance, and satellite costs with zero results, as underscored by Sayed Abdulmalik Badreddin al-Houthi in his speech last week. Meanwhile, Yemeni strategic operations continue to escalate significantly, effectively, and tangibly breaking the backbone of the Israeli entity economy, and it seems it won't cease as long as the Palestinian blood continues to flow, and tears of children and women continue to shed. It is a commitment that has been affirmed by the Yemeni leadership, and they will continue to adhere to it until the Israeli entity genocidal war stops and water, food, and medicine are delivered to Gaza.
To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Hamza Khansad, journalist and political analyst. Thanks a million for being with us, Mr. Hamza. Now, after its failure at the Red Sea, we see that Washington has resorted to classifying the Yemeni resistance movement Ansarullah as a terrorist entity, only to realize that such classification is just futile. It's nonsense. Ansarullah possess no assets or financial exchanges, neither in Washington or any other capital in the Atlantic, for that matter. Additionally, Sana'a is not inclined to retreat from its support that it has already declared as the operations in support of the people of Gaza. But what is next right now on the U.S. agenda concerning this issue in dealing with this unprecedented threat that they are facing in the Red Sea, the Arabian Sea, and the Gulf of Aden?
Greetings to you. Regarding the United States, there is a quasi-paralysis in dealing with what it perceives as threats directed at it and its allies by Ansar Allah. Especially since the beginning of this confrontation that has been going on since 2015, when Saudi Arabia declared what it called Operation Decisive Storm to change the reality in Yemen, much like Netanyahu attempting to change reality in Gaza. However, in Yemen, they dealt with a force that was a big surprise to them after 9 years of continuous aggression and blockade. Today, we have a version of Ansar Allah that runs a state with its security, social, economic, and cultural apparatuses, and conducts a real strategic supporting war in the Red Sea and the Arabian Gulf, imposing a serious blockade on the Israeli occupation entity and preventing ships from heading towards its ports. This is the result of 10 years of Saudi-supported American and British aggression and blockade. Today, the United States opted to designate the Ansar Allah movement as a terrorist organization, as it had previously classified it years ago, but then retracted. Today, they resort to the same defeated tools, just as their targeting of the Yemeni people themselves within Yemeni territory indicates that they have no clear objective, because these are the same targets that Emirati and Saudi warplanes targeted over 9 years of war on Yemen. Through our experience in understanding how Ansar Allah deals with reality, we have found that Ansar Allah does not deviate from the policies it adopts and does not calculate political considerations like neighboring countries do, or like mercenary movements in what was called the Arab Spring, which were characterized by rushing towards private interests instead of paying attention to national interests and the interests of the nation as a whole. For example, Ansar Allah did not use the Red Sea card throughout the years of the Saudi-American war on it. But today, it only uses it in support of the Palestinian cause, which is a fundamental principle of the Ansar Allah movement and the Yemeni government in general.
But Mr. Hamza, we did hear the Admiral Brad Cooper. He admitted, as you just said, that the U.S. forces in the Red Sea, in the Gulf of Aden, in the Arabian Sea, they are operating at what he said, and I quote, at a combat tempo unseen since World War II. One might listen to that and think, well, haven't the U.S. had any wars since then? But yes, they did, but they haven't had this kind of resistance maybe since then. Meanwhile, the Yemeni armed forces say that they are just using their old stockpile. They are not even using their new weapons yet. They are keeping that full power for maybe later. But how close is this confrontation to maybe an all-out explosion, not only in the Red Sea, but in the entire Arabian Peninsula?
The Yemeni armed forces have linked the operations in the Red Sea to what the Israeli occupation entity is doing in Gaza. They have stated that their operations are in support of the Palestinian people and resistance. Therefore, the cessation of operations is directly linked to halting aggression on Gaza and lifting the siege on the Palestinian people. Another condition was later added, which is when the Americans, along with the British, launched aggression on Yemen to try to alleviate pressure on the Israeli occupation entity and attempt to impose U.S. hegemony and control over the world through the Red Sea. Another condition was added, which is the cessation of American aggression on Yemen, and linking the level of Yemeni escalation to the level of American aggression on Yemen. As we saw last week, the Yemeni attack with ballistic missiles and drones in a manner that the Americans are not used to in an area where Washington has long considered itself the decision-maker and dominant force. And this is the advantage the Yemenis have today, that they openly and aggressively confront the United States. This is because the 9 years of Saudi-Emirati aggression on Yemen have prepared the Yemenis themselves and their missile arsenal, naval mines, and unmanned aerial weapons for a battle suitable for the geographical nature and nature of this enemy.
But there's another kind of threat that we have seen the U.S. and British intelligence use in Syria, for example, or in Lebanon, for that matter, is the security apparatus threats, which were issued by the Yemeni Minister of Interior and the Intelligence Security Agency, which revealed them thwarting a very malicious scheme sponsored by the United States of America and written to mobilize terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda and ISIS from Al-Baida to carry out assassinations and bombing campaigns in residential areas in Sana'a and other several provinces as well. Would you think that would be enough to alleviate maybe the pressure on the Yemeni naval operations in the Red Sea, make them stop or at least push it to halt at least its operations in support of Gaza?
In the recent period, we witnessed how the Saudis, Emiratis, Americans, and the broad coalition formed to fight Yemen have tried all recipes to break Yemen, from assassinations and massacres to mobilizing takfiri groups similar to what happened in Iraq and Syria in most of Yemen's provinces. They even funded and continue to fund separatist movements calling for the separation of southern Yemen from the north and eastern Yemen from the west. And speaking of new regions such as Hadramaut, where separatists have long demanded independence from Yemen. All these attempts were aimed at inciting discord in Yemen, in addition to the actual places that the United States, Britain, and even the Israeli occupation entity occupy strategically in Yemeni islands and areas. But all these attempts were defeated by the Yemenis. And today, we see the urgent need to complete the liberation operations to expel the occupying forces from Yemeni territory. Today there is talk of a different scenario, which is the rehabilitation of mercenaries in southern Yemen and what the United States calls the legitimate forces affiliated with the Aden government. These mercenaries are supposed to occupy the coastal strip, which includes many ports and areas overlooking the seas, with heavy air support from the British and Americans. Perhaps they will try, through these mercenaries, to wage a proxy battle, because they fully realize that their current battle has no horizon, unless they make a big decision to launch a ground operation in an attempt to eliminate the capabilities of the Yemeni armed forces. However, the Americans and the British will not be able to achieve their goals and persuade Ansar Allah to stop its operations in the Red Sea to support Palestine. Therefore, the plan to occupy the coastal strip is, for the Americans, the optimal plan to strip Ansar Allah of their areas of strength that bring them some financial returns.
But they fail to understand, maybe, Mr. Hamza, that even those in the south of Yemen actually agree with the operations being done by Ansar Allah in support of the people of Gaza, because the Western world still doesn't understand that Palestine is a very central cause for all of Arabs, not only for Ansar Allah in Yemen, all of Arabs, including the Yemenis who are in the southern part, who had a big problem with the Ansar Allah movement over the past 9 years. But I want to thank you very much, Mr. Hamza Khansa, journalist and political analyst, for joining us from Beirut. Thank you very much for your contribution to our show. And ladies and gents, thank you. Please stay tuned every week for more updates from here, the Middle East Stream. Assalamu alaikum.
Intisar Abu Sagar, who suffers from pancreatic cancer, is one of the 10,000 Gaza cancer patients waiting to get out of the territory and get treatment abroad. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, the Zionist regime's targeting of Gaza's hospitals has left its population of around 2.5 million Palestinians without adequate access to health care. Tens of thousands have been wounded in Israeli regime attacks, but those with long-term and terminal illnesses are also left with nowhere to go for treatment. Cancer patients and others who cannot leave have been left to their fate as the besieged territory's health facilities shut down, The Turkish-Palestinian Friendship Hospital, which served as the most important facility for cancer patients in Gaza, halted operations on October 30 because of the extensive damage caused by air strikes. Dr. Sophie Saik, the hospital's director general, announced the closure on the